WSJU Radio, St. John's University, Mad Max on the airwaves here with the one and only Chris the Mad Dog Russo. Mad Max with Mad Dog.
Yeah, I like that, Max. Nice to be with you, buddy. How you doing? Okay, pal?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing pretty all right. And before we start off with the main part of the interview and you're going to Rollins College and your career in the WFAN and Sirius XM, how are you feeling about the Giants?
The Giants are going to have probably a long year, though the manager did a better job last year than I thought. They have a lot of contracts coming off the books at the end of this year. So they're going to have a lot of money to work with at the end of the 2021 season. They're going to try to build it like the Dodgers built it, you know, because Farhan's 80 from that organization and the A's. So they're going to try to supplement a major league team with a good farm system, which the Giants have not had for a long time. And I think the Giants will be okay. I think it's going to take a couple years.
Yeah.
But I think the Giants, you know, will be okay. I mean, but again, they got to build up the farm system first. Tough division to deal with now because San Diego's in this to win. And of course, the Dodgers are not going away. So it will be a rough road for the Giants, Max. But, I think the days where they're just going to sort of work with veterans, you know, figure out a way to, you know, stay in the pennant race, add in July at the deadline and try to make a run for a championship. I don't think they're going to. They did that. They won three times that way.
Yeah.
I don't think the Giants would try it from that standpoint. I think they'd be a little bit more sustainable here, and I think that's how they're going to try to build the team. So this year's, you know, shaky, not making a playoffs in that National League, but down the road, I think the foundation will be built properly where they can be consistently good.
In your mind, who is the greatest Giant of all time? You have Willie McCovey, Willie Mays, or Barry Bonds?
Well, I can't put Bonds there because of the steroids. Yeah. So, I mean, I think everybody would agree that it's Mays. I mean, obviously, it's a two different prong attack because Mays played in New York. But if you're going to look at it just in the Giants' historical, in the history of the Giants, I mean, you know, there's about 10 or 12 people that you can consider. And if you want to consider Bonds, go ahead. You know, certainly Mays, Mellott, Christy Mathewson, Carl Hubbell, McCovey. There's a Marichal. I mean, there's about 7 or 8 to 10 guys that you could put in that. You know, it's funny, the teams that have won the three championships, I don't know if you'd put in that class. I mean, Bumgarner because of the postseason. But I don't know on a year-in, year-out basis if there's anybody that you could put in that class. But, you know, Mays, considering the fact that he's probably a top 8 player in the history of the sport, if that's the case, you can't say the Giants have 2 of the top 8. So yeah. I would say he's probably the greatest Giant of all time.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm sure Giant fans would agree with you as well. I want to go into the beginning of your radio career at going to college. Rollins College, why was that the perfect fit for you?
Well, I went to a boarding school in upstate New York, and one of my teachers up there in upstate near Albany, Darrow School, small 140-kid co-ed boarding school, one of the teachers there was from Selma, North Carolina, and he was very familiar with Rollins. Plus, my tennis coach my freshman year went to Rollins, so I had a little Rollins feel. Albany, New York is freezing in the wintertime, so Orlando, Winter Park, Florida had an appeal to it as well, small school. That had some appeal to it, too. Visited it in December of 77. I went to see Duke, North Carolina, and Rollins on the same trip and by myself. And it's hard not to like Rollins. It's on a lake. Winter Park's a beautiful town. And I think small, is only 1,300 kids when I was going there. So from that stand, they had a radio station. They had a campus radio station that was obviously important because I did not go to Syracuse or Ithaca, two places where I got accepted in, and that's, you know, I wanted to be a broadcaster. Rollins just fit the bill on a lot of levels. Again, the weather had a little something to do with it. I won't deny that. Small school had something to do with it. Radio station had something to do with it. Liberal arts college. And that's how I ended up there. And, you know, I had some affiliation with it because of the two teachers I had at Darrow. I get there in fall of 78. My father had never seen it. We drove down there with my parents, and my father fell in love with it right away. Yeah. So it was good. Start September of 78, and I graduated 4 years later, and I got a good education. Rollins is a party school, a lot of fraternity life, you know, a lot of running over to New Smyrna Beach on weekends. I mean, there's a lot to like about, you know, pretty co-eds. you know, sophomores driving Mercedes with thanks dad and a license plate. So, I mean, there's a lot about Rollins that is, you know, that's from that element. But, I mean, I got a good education, a good history department, and I got a good education. So when I graduated there in May of 82, you know, I wanted to be in radio, but I had a good background of history and political science. So I was in good shape. And they educated me is the most important.
That is the most important. How did your time at the college radio station there prepare you for the big leagues?
Well, I didn't do talk shows. So, I mean, what I basically did is I did a lot of play-by-play, and I was the last year or two, I was the sports director. So I made sure all the games got on the air. And Rollins has a good athletic program, Division II, but they have good basketball, good soccer, and good baseball. They've had pros in each sport. So I made, not in basketball, but they have in baseball. So I made sure that the games got on the air, and I did a lot of the games too. So, I mean, I don't know if it prepared me from an on-the-air standpoint, but I enjoyed it because, you know, I mean, I was doing play-by-play Division II basketball. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and tell you that that was that big a deal. Yeah. And I ended up doing talk radio anyway, and I didn't do any talk shows at Rollins. But just the radio atmosphere, putting together phone lines, traveling to the away broadcasts, getting a broadcast partner, doing a pre and post game show. I just had a feel of it. You know, I mean, I got a feel of it. This is an 80-81. It did not help me get a job because when I graduated from Rollins in May of 82, I did not get a job until the following February. Mm-hmm. So it took 9 months. So it wasn't like I went to Rollins and all of a sudden, wow, the Rollins College, how do we not hire this kid? Didn't work that way.
But WKIS.
Say again?
WKIS.
That was in Orlando. That was the second job I got. You know, the PRK job at Rollins, that did not really, it set me up. I knew how to do it, but it didn't get me a job. The first job I got was at WEXI in 1280 AM in Jacksonville. Then I got OKV 610 in Jacksonville, Talk Radio 60. And then I ended up at KIS in Orlando. So that was my third job in Orlando, second city. And then I ended up there for about 3-4 years. And I got the MCA in New York in March of 87.
Then you went to the Fan.
Right. I was at MCA for a couple of years. And I remember my first show at the Fan, they gave me an overnight gig. And that was in, that probably would have been in December of 88. Mm-hmm. I worked a little at the Fan December of 88. MCA, which was owned by Strauss Communications, they changed ownership. And a religious group bought them and made it an all-religious station. So I had to find something. And what I found was, you know, sort of part-time work on FAM, which had just started in July of 87. So I got there basically a year and a half later. And they gave me a lot of fill-ins. You know, I mean, I did overnights. I did, I filled in on all sorts of weird shows, Saturday nights. I mean, I basically just did what they told me to do, got on the air and did that. And in those days, they had updates every 20 minutes. You know, we were very much into the covering of the team. So, you know, guests were, you know, folks who were at the games covering it for us. John Classy, John Minko, Susan with the Knicks. So it was kind of a different format than it became a year or two later. And I got there basically about a month after Imus did. So, you know, and Imus became a Fan. I had an agent. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm doing morning drive with Imus, then Mike and me after Pete Franklin left. So I was lucky. You know, because you got to remember, I was at, I started my EXI career. That would have been, I started there in January of 83, February of 83. And I started with Mike September of 89. So in 6 years, I went from a small dawn to dusk radio station in Jacksonville, Florida, 1280 AM. And 6 years later, I was doing afternoon drive in New York. So that's pretty quick. So I was lucky.
It was quick. And in 9 months, when you guys were paired, you were the number one show instantly. What was it like the first time you met Mike? Not the first time you did the show together, because I've heard that story that he was quizzing you. And what was the first time that you actually met Mike?
Max is sharp, folks. He knows he's done a little work here. He's on top of it. How old are you, Max? You're a young kid. How old are you?
21.
Wow, that's pretty damn good. Good for you.
Thank you.
The first time I knew Mike in the hallways at FAN. Because Mike had been doing IMA stuff too. Mike had also worked with Eddie Coleman. They were doing 10 to 1. So Mike had a full-time spot there at FAN. So he got there before I did. And I think that, you know, it was a little feeling out process. You know, I didn't know Mike that well. You know, Mike obviously came from a different background than I did. I came from the radio background, you know, EXI, OKV in Jacksonville, KIS in Orlando, Gene Burns talk shows in a small town. Mike came from Brent and CBS and, you know, a researcher for big games, working in the college football, college basketball. You know, Pete Axton was a good buddy of Mike. So Mike came from a different background than I did. So it was a little weird. So I think there was a little bit more of a feeling out process. But Imus was a brilliant radio man, and he had a good relationship with Mike. A lot of the Seton Hall thing, when Mike picked Seton Hall to go all the way and almost won that red Porsche, that sort of, you know, got him going with Imus. And me being nutty got me going with Imus. So Imus had Mike and me. Mike was doing Eddie C. Pete Franklin has a contract dispute. And all of a sudden, Mark Mason decides, let's try these two together. And although we knew each other, hello, how are you? And, you know, we're cordial. I can't sit there and say that we, you know, knew the ins and outs of each other and how we did the radio show. So it took a little while from that standpoint. And then they threw us on the air together in September of 89. So it took a little while. You know, I remember that first week or so. Remember, I went away. I went to Puerto Rico. And I went to hang out in Puerto Rico before that first week started. And when I was away, Bart Giamatti died. The commissioner, he was in Martha's Vineyard, had the heart attack, and he passed away. And, you know, Mike was on the air. It was like a Friday afternoon, and Mike was on the air at the time. And so Mike had a big story right away to get his sink his teeth into. And I was not in the mix because I was in Puerto Rico. So it's almost like Mike had a head start, and it probably took me a little while to catch up. But I think once we realized that we both could help each other, Mike was a lot funnier than people thought. I knew a lot more about sports than people thought. And once we had a little success, and, you know, this partnership was what it was going to be. Obviously, you know, you work, you figure out a way, you know, all the ins and outs, and there's some ups and downs, but you realize that you're good for each other. And I think we realized that after a while. But again, the biggest thing I can tell you from my standpoint, February of 83, I start at EXI in Jacksonville. I get to MCA in March of 87, and I start with Mike in September of 89. So I was very, very fortunate. Jacksonville is not Racine, Wisconsin. It's a city. They had a renegade football team, the USFL. Orlando had the Renegades, who were the former Washington Federals. And so I knew all those players. I knew, you know, I worked with the team. You know, Flutie was in the league, Herschel Walker, the USFL, Sipe, Brian Sipe, the old Brown quarterback. And then all of a sudden, Pat Williams came and the Orlando Magic was put together. So I was fortunate in those two spots. I had some USFL Jacksonville Bulls. Lindy Infante was the head coach. Larry Zonka ran the team, the old Hall of Fame running back from the Dolphins. And then, of course, I was in the right place, right time, and I get to MCA, and it's New York City. It's a station that's got a great heritage. Nobody's listening to it. It's changed, but I can do what I want, 5:70 a.m. So I had a very hard apprenticeship for 6 years, but it was quick. So which is important.
Working with a co-host, how do you think it made you better as running your own show by yourself?
Well, remember, before I got with Mike, I basically did the shows by myself. So,
that's right.
You know, I kind of did everything solo prior to Mike. MCA was solo. KIS in Orlando was solo. I did have a partner in Jacksonville. But in Orlando and New York, it was solo. I realized, you know, it took a while. You know, you're not going to throw two people in there and all of a sudden you're going to click. It took a while, but I realized of how to orchestrate a show. I like to play the director. You know, in the heydays of Mike and Chris, I knew what made Mike tick and vice versa. So I knew how to go into breaks. I knew how to handle the pacing. So, I mean, there's a different dynamic when you're doing a show with two people than when you're doing it by yourself. When you're doing it with two people, you got to give the other person room. It's terrestrial radio, so you got to get the commercial breaks in. The pacing has got to be pretty good. You know, you got to do things that you may not love, i.e. say horse racing. And you have to realize, as Mike loved the horse racing, and, you know, you have to realize that there be things that you want to do that you got to put in a back burner, and goes both ways, because your partner is not into that today, and you got to do a good show first, not so much worry about your own deal. So, I mean, I just, you know, it took a long time now. I mean, you know, I'm 29 years of age. I was 29. I hadn't turned 30 yet. So it took a long time for me to understand the dynamic of the two-man team. Took a long time. And Mike, it took Mike a long time. And we realized that although Mike wanted the show by himself, and probably I did too, that was not going to happen. So if we were going to make this show successful, we were going to have to do this jointly. We each were going to have to give a little to get a little. And I think it took probably a couple of years for us to figure that out. But I think once we did, we realized that, you know, the show could be successful. And we hit New York at a perfect storm, Max. That's the most important thing. You got to look at the New York in the early 90s and the late 80s. You know, the Mets were still decent. The Giants won a championship in 90. Raleigh got to coach the Knicks. The Rangers get Messier. You know, the Yankees were, you know, bad, but, you know, it wasn't that much. You know, they got Buck in there in 93, 94. Here comes Joe Torre. You know, so there's a lot of things there that create a energy between a regular talk show and the city that you are working in. And New York got good with a lot of their teams. Rangers won a cup. Knicks were excellent. Giants won a championship. The Jets were at least competitive. You know, the Mets were bad, but sometimes that's good. You know, Bonilla and all that nonsense with him and Brett Saberhagen and Vince Coleman, that adds some juice to it. And, of course, you know, you got the football Giants who had the Parcells thing and, you know, and they won a couple Super Bowls. And then, of course, the second one we were involved with. And then he leaves and all the dynamics there. And I think we realized – and then the Yankees took over in 96. So I think we realized that the perfect storm hit in the 90s and in those two decades when Mike and I were rising as a team on a radio station that was 50,000 watts, 660 AM. So I had the first to do it. So all that converged at the perfect time.
You're exactly right. A 19-year run, an incredible run, legendary, made history. And as you mentioned before, the New York teams were doing well. The Knicks were doing well as they're doing well now. I want to ask you about a particular night in 1992 when you and Mike hosted Marv Albert night at the Garden.
Right. Boy, good job, Max. Yeah, that was Marv asked us to do that. It was his 25th anniversary with the Knicks. Marv asked, so 67, he must have became the full play-by-play guy. Marv asked us to do it. We hosted that at the Garden. I remember that when he played the Bulls that night. So you got Jordan sitting there at halftime as it goes long. I forget who we introduced at the half, but I remember I bought a Pat Riley suit at a Nick auction one year for juvenile diabetes at the Waldorf Astoria. Mike and I emceed that. And, you know, the Knicks, there was like a welcome home dinner. Mary Tyler Moore was there that night because juvenile diabetes with the great Mary Tyler Moore. And lo and behold, I had no idea that Mary Tyler Moore was a huge Mike and the Mad Dog fan. She lived up in Connecticut. You know, she married a younger doctor there who lived in Brooklyn. So she used to drive all the time from Brooklyn to Connecticut, you know, on weekends. And she loved Mike and the Mad Dog, which we had no idea. Mary Tyler Moore. I mean, geez, we had no idea. And I remember they had an auction that night for the Riley suit. And I did two things. I bought the Riley suit, number one, for $2,200. And I bought a Nick trip to the Boston Garden to see the Knicks play the Celtics and fly up there with Dave Checketts on a, I don't remember if it was private. It may have been private up and commercial back. Anyway, to fly up to see the Knicks and the Celtics. And it was the first time I had seen a basketball game at the old Boston Garden and Bird at 32. And that same night, I bought the Riley suit. Long story short, I wore that Riley suit at the Marv Albert thing in 1992. I don't know what the month was, but I remember wearing that suit, and I've seen video of it and everything else. And I know the Knicks played the Bulls that night at the Garden. And I was a big night, you know, doing that. I also played a 3-on-3 halftime basketball game at the Garden once. Knicks played the Heat. And we played 3-on-3 at the half in front of 19,000. Bernard McGurk, me, and I forget who else. I remember that, too. We were very close to the Knicks in those days because the Knicks were getting good.
Yeah.
You know, we were very close to the Knicks in those days.
It's the first time that they had a winning record since 2013. I was in eighth grade.
2013, right now. Yeah. And the Knicks have done a good job. Thibodeau, of course, the whole nine yards. You know, the Knicks were a big story for us because Riley was very good to us. You know, he used to come on all the time. Riley understood passion. He understood enthusiasm. He knew Mike and me had it. I think, you know, a guy like Riley's never going to love the media, but Pat certainly, I think, respected what me and Mike did and always never said no. Came on all the time. Game 7 NBA final, Knicks Rockets came on in 505. Knicks Bulls came on all the time. We had a really good relationship with Riles. One of my all-time favorites. All time.
What are some of the major differences of working for AM, FM radio and now Sirius XM, which you did years ago back in 2008, which is satellite radio? And what were the benefits of it? Because you were able to have complete control of your own channel, Channel 82 on Sirius XM.
I think from a talk show perspective, I think the biggest difference is you don't have a hometown team, mm-hmm. which is good and bad. You know, in New York, when you're doing local radio in our day, you know, you centered it on the 5, 6, 7 New York teams. And, you know, you could go 5 hours on why, you know, Jeff Torborg pinch hit in the top of the 8th inning, 3-3 in Candlestick. You know, you can't do that. You can't do that on Sirius. So you can always rely on a hometown call on FAN, on local radio, and you can center every show around New York local teams, you know, especially every sport except for football, which you got to do a little more national. Can't do that on Sirius. You know, the person in Walla Walla, Washington is not that wrapped up in what's going on, you know, with the Knicks Pistons at the Garden. So there is more of a tendency to look for big picture topics than there are, you know, those topics that center around the local club. So that is good and bad. The good is that it gives you tremendous flexibility. You can do what you want, and you can find anything that might hit a chord with the fan base. And the negative is there are days where nothing's going to hit the chord, and you can't rely on the hometown team to carry a day on the air. So there is a negative and a positive. The flexibility is the great positive, and the negative would be the idea that you can't go in there and center it on the club. You don't really have a home. You don't have a hometown team, and I think that makes it. I think you at times that can make it a little tricky. As far as running a channel, you know, I did that for 5 years. It's a lot of work. You know, because you got to be a boss and you got to make some tricky decisions, and you got to let the talk show hosts be the talk show hosts. You know, Sirius XM in those days, they were going to pay me, but they were not going to go out there and pay the guy doing 10 to midnight a lot of money. So, I mean, it was tricky from, you know, to hire people. You had to get them into New York City, and they weren't going to move you. So it was tricky. Yeah, but, you know, I think that we put together, you know, we've changed a lot. But I think for the most part, we've put together a pretty good channel. We've evolved. We've made some, you know, we made some changes even recently with Pat McAfee. So we may, you know, try to, you know, hit the younger crowd a little more so than, say, the old standard sports talk, like sort of what I might represent. But I think overall we've made our inroads, bottom line. You know, at that time when I left, Mike, it was time to make a change. I was 48 years of age, 19 years. You know, I had done everything I was going to be able to do at FAN. I wouldn't have gone anywhere. I wouldn't have gone to ESPN. I wouldn't have done 10:50 a.m. I wasn't going to go up against Mike. You know, but Sirius XM, when they gave you your own channel, they made it Mad Dog Radio. I thought that that was a situation I couldn't say. It wasn't because of the money. I remember I gave away a lot of money because I didn't have a simulcast with Yes. Because when I left FAN, you know, I left the Yes deal too because I was no longer going to be on Yes. I knew I was going into some sort of obscurity. So I knew that. You know, and from my, everybody thinks, well, Chris left because they paid him a fortune. I was making good money at FAN. I mean, I left because of the fact I figured, you know what, time to go, try something new. I had a lot of confidence in Mel Karmazin. And I thought that this might be, at this point in my life, before I turn 50, a chance I may not get again. This is something to give it a chance and give it a try. So I did.
Last two questions I have for you. Are you planning on writing a third book to the other two sports books that you wrote? And what's an important piece of advice that you can give someone that's in college radio right now who may be listening to this interview when it's aired?
The books are hard because, you know, part of writing a book and making it successful is the promotions of it. The first book I wrote in 2003, you would be amazed of how many signings I did and speeches at bookstores. I probably did 30. And I don't mean a speech that lasted 10 minutes. I mean a 40-minute speech and then, you know, long lines of signing 300-400 books. And I was there 3-4 hours in an afternoon. So the promotion angle of selling a book is as much difficult as actually putting it, you know, in print. I don't see that right. I did two of them. I don't see me doing that right now in my immediate future. As far as the advice I give, I would still go, you know, there's two things I'd say. One, in my day, when you wanted to get started, you went to a radio station. You know, 30, 40 years ago, if you wanted to start in radio, that's what you did. You started in a radio station. You went to a small town's radio station somewhere and wherever it might be, mostly AM, and do everything they told you to do. Go cover the PSA meeting. Go cover the high school basketball game. You know, go do the 11 o'clock nightly, you know, news. You know, go do updates. Go do anything. And do it in a small town and, you know, learn that way. That's what I did. Now, I don't know if that's the same way. And that's 1982. That's 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the same way to do that now, because there are so many different things that one can do to carve out a little niche for yourself. But I still think the old-fashioned way is the best way to go. And I still think getting involved in a decent media outlet, whoever that might be, where you can do a little bit of everything, I think that's your best bet. I think going out there out of college and, you know, all of a sudden, well, let me do a podcast. Well, there's a billion podcasts. What makes you think that your podcast is going to be listened to? There's a million of them. So, I mean, or I'll go out there and I'll go write for a blog. Well, there's a million blogs. You want to be in a situation where you can stand out a little bit, where your uniqueness can shine through. And I think finding that avenue is the hard part, you know, and that's what I would recommend. I would recommend a kid who's a broadcaster, who wants to be in broadcasting. I would recommend going somewhere where, you know, it's a KMOX in St. Louis. Not that you're going to get a job like that out of college. You go to KMOX in St. Louis, I mean, people listen to that station. Yeah. They do the Cardinals, you know, they do the Blues, you know. I mean, that's a Costas work there. You know, Dan Kelly worked there. Jack Buck worked there. I mean, there's a market for it. That's what I would do. Now, again, I don't know if somebody wants to pack up their belongings and go to St. Louis to start their career. The other thing I would recommend, if you're 23 years of age, don't tie yourself down. No serious girlfriends, no children to 24 years of age. Don't have 4 dogs. I mean, I just wouldn't do it. This career is very difficult and you need flexibility to move right away, and you don't want to have to worry about putting food on the table. So from that standpoint, you want to worry about yourself. So from that standpoint, if you really want to try to be successful in this business in media, you're young 20s, plenty of time to get married, plenty of time to be a father. I don't think you have to do that for the first 4 or 5 years. Get your career organized first and then go in that department.
Well said, Chris. Thank you. I appreciate it. Anything else you'd love to tell the audience up here at St. John's University?
St. John's is a wonderful place. I remember in October 5th, 1 year on Midnight Madness, Mike and I did a show on a Saturday night, Midnight Madness, when Felipe Lopez was a freshman, his first practice, and Brian Mahoney was the head coach. I remember that very, very well. I remember Mike went to St. John's, so we did a lot of broadcasts for St. John's. And I remember Also, David Halberstam did the St. John's games on radio. And I remember one time he asked me to do the games with him. One game, I think I did the Providence game, and Halberstam let me call the second half. So I got a little St. John's blood in me, just like everybody else does. Plus, my old partner went to St. John's. My best friend went to St. John's. You know, I love the Johnnies. So from that standpoint, good for you, Max. And you did a wonderful job here. Sharp, on point, knew what you were doing and had an impact. So I give yourself some credit. Well done.
Thank you, Chris. Anything else? Is that it? That's the final words.
That's the best I can give you right now. Stay peppy, stay enthusiastic. And remember, when you're doing a radio show, nobody wants to hear about your bad day. The people listening have had a bad day, maybe. They want to hear you having a bad day. So when you're on the radio, in any shape, way, or form, or on television, be enthusiastic. Be peppy.
You're right.
That sells.
You're right. Chris Russo, I want to thank you for coming on the show here today. Thank you for what you did for radio. It was an honor.
All right, Max. Good job, Al. Appreciate it very much.
Take care and stay safe.
Okay, buddy.
Yep.